Can you hear me?
Hi, Katrina. Yes. Sorry.
I'm sorry. These are experimental times as well as we try this with you, so bear with us. You know, I don't know about you, but I feel these are this is a moment infused with hope and fear in roughly equal measure, yeah. But it's also a time, as we sit here at the nation, we believe of new possibilities, that out of crisis comes opportunity. And as this old order we've lived with, this economy, is being discredited, what will come next, laying out the ideas, agitating for them, driving them into the debate and onto the agenda is very much part of our work here at the nation. There's hope. I mean, how many times have we met in these last years to share our revulsion about the White House's occupants? And I don't know how many of you had a chance to watch last night's press conference. You know, it revealed a president of great intelligence. I mean, there are all kinds of things we could say, and we say them week in, week out, hour in, hour out at thenation.com or at the nation. But Barack Obama is someone who's given us a budget, however flawed, which is a blueprint or a down payment on a new progressive era. And he's a president who values scientific integrity, who understands the importance of government activism, says labor is part of the solution, not the problem. Of course we have concerns about civil liberties stance of this administration, the dangers of escalation in Afghanistan. We've been out front on that issue and working with the coalition in Congress to hold hearings to avoid that quagmire. And we share concerns about various appointments. But we're also of the view that it's worth engaging this administration. I mean, there are allies inside our cover story just at the end of last year by Van Jones. Van Jones, this charismatic African-American, is now the green czar in this administration, leading the way toward a greener economy. So these are times of fear and of hope. Today, we wanted to talk with you about what is at the forefront of so many people's minds, the economic crisis. And toward that, and we have as our special guest, as Peg said, one of America's most lucid analysts of our economy, Jeff Madrick. And Jeff was with us, I'd just like to say a word, Jeff was with us at an event we held earlier this month at Ethical Culture in New York, because as this crisis has deepened, the nation and its various moving parts, thenation.com, our writers on television and radio, at events is the one we did, at emergency forums on the economic crisis, as we're doing around the country. We're doing an event in Detroit in this spring. Jeff was there. Jeff was there along with Joe Stiglitz, Barbara Ehrenreich, and Bill Fletcher to provide markers as to what we can and must do to craft a people's recovery. We had to turn away about 1,000 people that night. There's so much hunger for the discussion we're about to have on this phone call. So with all of that, I'd just like to say one last thing, which is that, you know, our writers and thinkers, and Jeff has been such a valued contributor to the nation, that we have just received a National Magazine Award nomination for Naomi Klein's incisive commentaries on the economy and how to develop alternatives, how to reimagine a new world. But to the focus of our call, Jeff Madrick, editor of Challenge Magazine, a visiting professor at Cooper Union, whose most recent book, which we excerpted, is The Case for Big Government. Jeff is a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books, a valued contributor, as I said, to the nation. And Jeff is going to walk us through, in about 5 minutes, walk us through how to think about the bailout plan, the policies and politics of this moment, and what are the challenges on three fronts in the period ahead. And then we're going to open it up for conversation, take questions from you for about 15 minutes, and go from there. So, Jeff, welcome, and thank you for being part of the call.
Well, thank you, Katrina. It's a pleasure to be here. Hello, everybody. One thing I do want to say right at the outset is this is still a battle. Obama's victory, as I'm sure you all agree, was a great victory, and I'm certainly a personal fan of the man. But there's a lot of fighting to do, and I think that's becoming more evident all the time. His budget plan is being whittled away by Democrats. EFCA, the Employee Free Choice Act, is now lost Senator Specter, and may lose that battle for broader union representation. So the battle goes on. In some sense, I suppose, it's just beginning. And, of course, I have to emphasize the nation's special place in that battle. Imagine where we would be without it. Having said that, let me tell you where I think the economy is. I generally don't describe the economy as a crisis. I describe it as a state of emergency. It started out, or seemed to start out, as the end of that housing bubble, which everyone suspected could happen. Some were certain could happen. That very few, despite what they may say in retrospect, understood how dangerously it would unwind. For example, Bob Shiller, who was one of the leading leading economists who saw this bubble and thought it would burst, was asked by Senator Schumer's people, well, could the GDP absorb it? And he thought, he said, yeah, I think it could absorb the burst bubble fairly easily. What he hadn't reckoned on, and what I think relatively few people reckoned on, was the extraordinary risk that was taken on by Wall Street and its many institutions. Risk that the federal government was clearly and completely unaware of, had apparently vested interest in looking the other way. And that risk, by which I mean borrowing a lot of money to buy very risky assets that paid very well momentarily, but were much riskier than understood and now started generating losses. And those losses are exacerbated by that heavy debt. That froze up the credit system, and that made a deep recession inevitable. So where do we stand today? Here, I think, is how to look at this. People are losing jobs. They're scared as heck. They've lost a lot of money in houses, $12 or $13 or $14 trillion in assets combined, houses and stock prices. They're cutting back on their spending aggressively. Remember, Americans saved almost nothing on average, partly because so many borrowed so much and most of the rest didn't save very much. If we raise our savings rate, not to the rates of the early 1990s, for example, but just to 5%, the rates of the late 1990s, not a very high rate, it will immediately withdraw, suck out of the economy $750 billion of demand for goods and services. The way that works, and that is happening right now, the way economies work is when the demand for goods and services start to fall like that, it generates all kinds of other detrimental ramifications. It becomes a big feedback loop. So people buy less, business makes less, fewer sales, more go out of business. They fire still more workers, don't give raises to others, don't have money themselves. That withdraws even more demand for the economy, and it goes in a bigger and bigger circle. What makes that especially dangerous right now is as people lose money and as business makes less money and some of them lose it, they start to default more on that mortgage debt, and business starts to default on its corporate debt. And that makes the credit system even more vulnerable and harder to bring back, harder to turn the tap on. So we're fighting this battle on three fronts: the housing front, the credit front, the banking Wall Street front, and the conventional recession front, which is now likely to be very steep and in retrospect may be called a depression. Obama has done well, President Obama and his team, I think, has done pretty well in getting a stimulus package of $800 billion out there very quickly. We need at least that. Most people would argue we need much more than that, but I think it's commendable that he moved that quickly and got it up front and got an awful lot of support for it. I think we've got to support that strongly. To me, that's an A. The housing, and can he forestall, can he stop the increasing numbers of defaults in the housing market? His team put out a plan on housing. I would give it a B. I think it will work to some degree. I think it should have been more aggressive, but at least it will be moderately effective. It doesn't deal with those people who have mortgages that are worth more than their houses are now worth. That's a problem. But let's give that a B. The third front is the credit front. And that, I think, they have not done very well on. I believe it's because Obama picked a team with little outside, with little influence on the part of others, picked a team who were wedded to a kind of Wall Street outlook on how the markets worked and how they might work best. So we've waited a long time for a plan, and we finally got one. This week, the stock market went up. The stock market went up not because it was an ideal plan, and I surely don't think it was an ideal plan, but at least it is a plan that's out there, and we'll begin the process of our trying to understand how bad the assets are on the books of these banks. I don't think it will be a final solution. I think it's a bit of an unfortunate plan, but having said that, I'm pretty glad it's out there. Now we've got to see where that goes from here. So the upshot is maybe we're starting to generate some decent policies. I still think the third front, the credit crisis front, is an open question, and I think they're going to have to adjust rather rapidly. But I want to bring up one other point, Katrina, and you folks are kind enough to listen to me. What happens when we do solve these problems? What happens when we get past the crisis or the state of emergency? Where is the economy at that point? Now, to the new president's credit, and I think it's fairly remarkable, he has developed a stimulus plan that begins to look in the direction of rebuilding this country. He talks about energy, health care, and education. I think it could be a broader list. But he has at best made a down payment, to use Katrina's term, a down payment on rebuilding America, on what that new economy should look like as we go forward. And it's going to take continued money, intelligent programs, and continued political fighting to get done what America must do. I don't know any time when we had, after 30 years of an anti-government ideology, when we have had a to-do list that is so large. Not merely to make America a good place to live or to reinforce our traditional values, but to make America moderately competitive in the world and to give us a chance to compete reasonably well in a new global world. In my view, the foundations on which the economy has been built for a long time are crumbling, and little attention has been paid to it until the last couple of years. The Clinton administration did not pay nearly adequate attention to those foundations. They are pre-K education. They are infrastructure, energy alternatives, serious reform of the healthcare system, and several other categories as well that I think are imperative. The last point I want to make is what I consider the most important one. America is on its way to becoming a low-wage society. There are a lot of factors that contributed to that. In the early days since the 1970s, low productivity growth. More recently, offshoring and foreign competition. But key, I believe, has been a lack of government attention to the plight of workers in America. The lack of government attention that government gave workers ever since the 30s, and really in some respects since the late 1800s and early 1900s. We stopped raising the minimum wage. We undermined unions significantly. We let Wall Street utilize financial techniques like leveraged buyouts, which inevitably made workers the victims because these men and women bought these companies by borrowing heavily, and to pay back that borrowing, when they took over a company, they had to cut costs drastically. And the first costs they cut were workers. Keep wages down and cut those workers. And that was the Wall Street definition of lean and mean. We had a number of policies like that. A lot of people don't recognize, don't remember the Paul Volcker, who I believe was a little too tough on inflation in the bad old early 1980s, wanted actually to modify those LBO policies because he thought they were too onerous in the mid-1980s. And Reagan appointees to the Federal Reserve diluted what he wanted to do. So he was always eager. He always saw that Wall Street was being was developing and evolving in a way that would make the worker the victim. So, to summarize my final point, we are not hearing enough from the Obama administration about how to keep wages up in America. It was part of the public discourse during the Democratic nomination, part of the public discourse during the presidential campaign, and it has faded away. Because wages were low, Americans borrowed a lot. Because they borrowed a lot, we got into a situation where we can't pay back what we owe. Assets went up, now they're down. To lead America forward, we've got to enable workers to make enough money so that they can save, so that the nation as a whole can save, so we're less dependent on borrowing, and we can go forward the way we always went forward. America, since the colonial years, always paid the highest wages on average in the world, and we grew the fastest in the world. It became the largest economy by the 1890s, and as all of you know, in the 1950s and 60s, we grew remarkably rapidly, both with high taxes and high wages growing rapidly for all Americans. We can do that again. I'm going to stop there. I hope I can.
Thank you, Jeff. No, thank you for that very clear, humane presentation. I want to open it up to those of you on the call.
Katrina, let me just give some ground rules here.
Please.
I can do that. Okay. For those of you who are logged into the web interface, and there are a few of you, you can submit your questions in the chat box, which should be right in the middle of your screen on the right-hand side. For those of you who've called in and are not logged in on the web, we'll be taking your questions and comments over the phone. If you're interested in asking a question, you should press the star key on your phone, and you'll be added to the question queue. If you're selected to ask a question or make a comment, you'll hear a chime tone right before being connected live. Once you hear that chime, I'll read the last four digits of your telephone number, and we'll call on you, and that's how you'll speak. And also, please be sure to tell us your name and where you're calling from. Please keep your questions and comments brief, on topic, and to the point, no longer than a minute or so. If you continue a bit too long, we'll remind you to move towards wrapping it up. We apologize in advance if we're not able to get to every single question or comment. And finally, we invite you to send us an email at rsvp@thenation.com if you have any additional comments or questions that we haven't been able to get to today. And we also invite you to write to us at that email address, rsvp@thenation.com, to let us know how you found the whole conference call experience. So let's take our first call.
Can I jump in for a second, Peg?
Sure.
This is Victor Novasky, Peg, and Katrina. Just one question. Jeff,
yes.
What would you do to get wages up?
I would significantly raise the minimum wage. I would actively promote living wage programs through government leadership. If you want a government contract, you have to pay living wages and promote those at local levels. I would unquestionably expand union leadership, union coverage. I think unions are not, the lack of union coverage has seriously hurt the nation. Unions are never always perfect either, but our coverage has been tragically low. In fact, unions are a pretty good way to keep CEO salaries down, frankly, in the ballpark. It's, you know, in unionized industries, those differences between CEO pay and average wages is always shorter. But let me just mention one or two. The economy can grow faster than it has grown. The emphasis on keeping inflation low was taken too far during the Volcker years and during the Greenspan years, except for the late 1990s. We can get unemployment lower, and as we saw in the late 1990s, wages at all levels went up when we got the unemployment rate lower. There is an obsession with inflation, which is just not warranted. That doesn't mean we throw all caution to the wind on that, but we have seriously gotten carried away. And I think that the president has to create an environment, a cultural environment, that respects workers again, because I think, though we are all workers, and somehow or other we seem to forget that, some of us in America seem to forget that, there has been a cultural acceptance of the fact that lower wages are always okay. It's the way to economic growth. And the president, I believe, can show the leadership by respecting workers again and by calling attention to abuses of workers, show the leadership to change that point of view, that national point of view. That's my list, Victor.
Okay. All right, we're going to take our first question. It's from area code 973, and your phone number ends in 5589. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yes, hi. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
I'm Dr. Mark Tolpin. I'm a pediatric infectious diseases and immunology specialist, and I'm calling from West Orange, New Jersey. From Millburn, New Jersey.
Oh, okay. What is your question?
It's more of a comment I'd like to throw out. I would like and like to get some input on from the panel. I'm in my low 60s now, and it has seemed to me ever since I was young that it's been pretty apparent that even back then, for example, we were 5-6% of the world's population. We were consuming 15% of its output every year. Now we're more like about 10% demanding 25% of the world's output. Clearly, somebody was going to step in there and say, look, we've got to stop this, and we've got to, we want our share. And I think what we're seeing in part now is a confluence of bad humors, if you will, where the countries like with large emerging economies such as China and India are battling for a little bit bigger piece of the pie, and we're going to have to accept that as part of our paradigm going forward. I don't think that we will quite be able to live without saving or live off the hog. And I could go into a whole bunch about how this impacts medicine and so forth, but we'd defer that to a later time. I've also sort of seen, and this I'll use to conclude, there seems to be a basic disconnect or dichotomy in the society, specifically the underpinnings of the economy is capitalism, and yet this is a democratic republic on paper and in philosophy. Now, industry itself is anything but a republic. Even in Athens, if you were a slave or a woman, you didn't get to participate. So it appears as if there's a disconnect there. People work in the milieu of an oligarchy or a monarchy, depending on whether we have a CEO or a board that's dominant during the day, and then they go home and expect things to be different in the evening. And that also predisposes to large amounts of quick profit, because the uppers in a lot of these institutions therefore will go for something that looks sexy and good, even though they may know darn well that 5 years later it's not going to be so great. We've seen this with Drexel Burnham. We've seen this, you know, with the period during the Carter years. We're seeing it again now. We've seen it umpteen times before that. And we never learn from experience. So I just like to submit all that for comment.
If I might, just very briefly, I welcome it if you would come to thenation.com and also in the magazine where we've been having a spirited conversation about socialism in these times. Barbara Ehrenreich has led it off. But there's also been Bill Greider, who in our pages as well as in his new book, Bring America Home, has some very intriguing original ideas about democratizing capital, democratizing the corporation, re-engaging citizens. And whether it's a measure of the zeitgeist of these times or whatever, he did have a big cover story in the Washington Post last Sunday, because I think with all the congealing of conventional wisdom that still happens at this time of crisis, there is an awareness that there is a need for new thinking of the kind that Bill Greider has been doing in The Nation, moving out of our pages into the broader culture.
Okay, should we... Jeff, did you want to respond
yeah.
to that one way?
Well, I think the gentleman made his case well. I don't think I have... let me try with after some other comments too.
Okay,
come back
we'll take another question. Okay, the next question comes from area code 718, and the number ends in 7160. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, who's this?
This is Franz Alana in Riverdale in the Bronx.
Hi, Franz. How are you?
Fine.
What's your
thanks.
Question today?
My question for Jeff Madrick is whether he has any confidence, whether he has more confidence in the approach in the financial and credit problem area, whether he's got more confidence in the approach that consists of bailout in which government partners with private enterprise, or whether he would have more confidence in a kind of nationalization of banks where there's a concerted and hopefully a successful effort to get the government to get out of its control and ownership position sooner rather than later.
Let me address that immediately, then. I am not a big fan of the private-public partnership approach. I don't think it's necessary to set prices, I think. On the other hand, I don't think we can broadly nationalize, nationalize is not quite the right word. I don't think we can broadly take over and reorganize these banks the way the FDIC did, all of them. I think probably we have to do some of them, but everybody should understand that comes at a serious cost. All these banks, Citigroup, the troubled banks, Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, have big liabilities. Most of us are part of those liabilities if we have any savings accounts or if we own any CDs at banks. When you take them over, all of those have to be paid off, and they don't have the assets to pay them off. So the federal government would have to step in with a lot of money right off the bat, a lot of money to make nationalization work. I'm not so sure it would be that much less money than to start at the bad bank, and it would probably not be less money than to do the program they're now undertaking. So I would like to see, in my ideal world, I'd like to see some nationalization of these banks and removal of management. I do not think the old management can handle it. I think they are too embedded in their businesses and too embedded culturally and psychologically in terms of what how to make money, how to compensate people, and so forth. I also think we probably have to try to make these securities markets work, and we need some kind of bad bank, good bank approach, and we need the government trying to make some markets in these securities. So I'm a hybrid in that regard. I don't think there's an easy answer with nationalization. I don't think the current public-private partnership is the right answer. But I do think, having said that, as I said in earlier comments, that this at least is a first step towards trying to get some handle on what those darn bad assets are really worth. Now, what upsets me most, perhaps, is that the Treasury Department under Paulson and to some degree under Geithner, though I blame him less, even though he was with Paulson, are operating without sufficient knowledge, and maybe even Bernanke at the Fed. There should be an army of examiners in these banks trying to figure out what these assets really are, and then we can make some firm judgments about it. But I don't know if I'm being adequately clear. Let me just restate it. Partial nationalization of a couple of banks, getting rid of much of this management, and trying to make some of these securities markets work so we can price these assets finally and get a sense of where these banks really stand and which ones can survive and which can't. And finally, and here's perhaps the issue that's not coming up enough, the Geithner team seems to take as given that we have to get these banks to work the way they once did in the old days, and I think that's probably dead wrong. I think we have to rationalize this industry differently, and if they had an overall plan, it would be much easier to come up with a bank rescue. In my view, banks that take savings deposits, FDIC-insured savings deposits, should be restricted from a lot of risky activities the way they used to be in the 50s and 60s, and before Walter Wriston and other people like him started whittling away the regulations. Then we can re-regulate the shadow banks, the investment banks and so forth, and demand capital requirements from them and lots of disclosure. That could be where the innovation is. And insurance companies should totally be set aside. So I would have loved to have seen the Obama administration be smart enough to have an overall approach, a sense of what the future of banking would look like, and then come up with their bank rescue plan. And I just don't think they're doing that.
Here's
okay, we're going to take another question. We just got a chat question from Jonathan Wallach, and Jeff, I think you've actually answered that. So we're going to move on to another telephone call. It's area code 206, number ends in 7200. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank you. My name is Steve Gerritsen. I'm calling from Seattle, Washington. All right. I have two questions. They're very closely related for Jeff. One is, given your comments in response to Mr. Novosky's question, do you see a fundamental difference in approach is necessary between dealing with unemployment and dealing with low wages? And second, I've heard the article on nonprofits in The Nation this past week, I've heard from a number of nonprofits that they may not be able to accept the energy efficiency money because of the Davis-Bacon requirement. Could you comment on those?
Yeah, I don't know too much about the second. Maybe somebody else does. On the first issue, unemployment and wages are integrally related. When unemployment is low, labor markets are tight. Businesses have to raise wages to attract employees and to keep employees who could go somewhere else. That's not only a theory. It's borne out empirically in history. So perhaps the best way to get wages up is to run the economy hotter, as I would say, and get that unemployment rate down. What happened since the 1970s and the rise of Friedmanite economics is we began to believe, and that includes economists who advise Democrats, began to believe that you shouldn't get the unemployment rate down because it would always provoke inflation. Well, I think in the 1970s there were a peculiar set of circumstances that made that happen, but that ended in the 1980s, and we could have been more aggressive. That could have gotten unemployment rates down and wages up, and there were other factors. I didn't actually get to my whole list. Not least of them is enforcing the labor laws, which are remarkably abused in this country, minimum wage laws, hour laws, union organizing laws, and so forth. And let me say one other thing, and I think this is relevant to what the gentleman asked. The high dollar has hurt. We've had a high dollar policy for a very long time in America. It was one of the prides, actually, of Bob Rubin and the Clinton administration. The high dollar made it easy for us to borrow funds from overseas and made it easy for us to become a highly indebted society. But it also made it much harder for us to export manufacturers. It seriously undermined manufacturing. It's quite amazing that this really wasn't central to the public discourse. And I think that was that was symbolic or emblematic of the success of this this neoclassical ideology, that whatever the dollar did was okay, and indeed a high dollar was a sign that we were strong, and we would ignore the fact that it was undermining what made us strong in the first place. So without a strong manufacturing sector, and we can't be as strong as we were because times do change, but without that, you're not going to make many good jobs for people who have only high school educations, for example. So that undermined our wages also. A lower dollar, maybe a new Bretton Woods II system that people are talking about, enforcing the labor laws, and I hope I get a chance to say a little bit about taxes. Before our phone conversation is finished.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Okay, we're going to take just a couple more questions and then move on to our State of the Nation update. But our next call is from area code 253, last four digits 8888. Can you hear us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. This is Bill Naren in Gig Harbor, Washington.
Hey,
and given the fact that this, what we're going through now, seems to be a recurring cycle over the years, and I'm wondering, are we seriously questioning the whole capitalistic system as a valid economic system? And if we are, what is to supplant it? And I've been searching for an answer until a friend of mine put me onto the modern gun experiment in the Basque area of Spain, where a co-op was really fantastically economically an economic system for that whole town of Madrigan. And I'm just wondering, you know, the co-ops were strong in the last two decades of the 1800s and then kind of got wiped out. But at least it's a voter-owned economy, rather than a two-class economy where we have the bosses and the wealth and the workers. And I guess my question is, why isn't there more discussion about challenging the very basis of the capitalistic system, which is based upon greater consumption?
Probably Katrina and Victor may want to talk about this, because they've been a lot of nation contributors have been talking about the relevance of a modern socialism. My view of it is there are many kinds of capitalism, and the idea we have of capitalism now is a pretty attenuated one and an extremely damaging one. You notice when people are all, like the head of the Republican National Committee said, only businesses create jobs, and even Geithner, the first time he talked about his bailout plan a few weeks ago, said, President-elect Obama, when he was running, said he recognizes that it's business who creates jobs. Well, you know, I think government creates jobs. We need a seriously different attitude about that. Government creates educated workers, creates healthy workers. It creates roads and bridges that enable us to have commerce. It creates sanitation systems that enable us to build cities and so forth. We've really distorted the nature of our own history. And I do think it is troubling that we have had so many booms and busts in our history. I do not think America has been a perfect place, and we could utilize government in much more constructive ways. But I think some mixture, a mixed economy, is the right way to go.
Jeff, this is Ham Fish in New York.
Hi.
I wanted to ask you if you'd address a complex question in as brief a way as you can, having generally to do with revenues and the financing for the current scheme. Are there untapped tax revenues that we should be looking at with regard to things like offshore activity? Should we be anxious about putting these printing presses to work over time, generating more currency, and what do you think is the ongoing appetite of the international buyer for the kind of federal paper that they've been consuming in the last period?
On the first one, yeah, I think there are lots of loopholes. You know, we know that the high end pays, what, 17% of taxes, income taxes, corporate loopholes. I think I would love to see the Obama administration attack that vigorously. Corporations pay a far smaller proportion of the GDP in taxes than they once did, and I think of a lot of that as pretty much flimflammery. On the second issue, and I'm trying to be quick and brief, are we borrowing too much? You have to look at where we are today. What is the alternative? The alternative would be very high deficits, and we'd be in a very big hole, because recession means deficits, because incomes fall and therefore tax revenues fall sharply. Are we borrowing so much that we can't handle it in the future? I don't think so. I think it would raise in any sensible, if we grow in any reasonable way after we get past this crisis, we will be able to get those debt levels down, even though the baby boomers are going to stop working. And the increase in debt service, the interest and the payback of the principals, would not come to more than another 1 or 2% of GDP. I think that's a pretty fair, uncontroversial way to look at it. Are we creating too much money? Well, you don't create money until the banks start lending it, because I see this on ABC and so forth. People say, look at all these monetary reserves. Well, the banks can make loans if they meet capital requirements and if people want to borrow the money and if those credits look good. That monetary base, those reserves, don't become money until the loans are made and they go into a bank deposit. Your listeners should be very clear about that, the people on this phone call. It doesn't become money until then. Could we have an inflationary surge? I doubt that that's going to happen even in the medium and long run. But we can cut back on that. It does probably mean we're not going to grow very as rapidly as we might have otherwise. There is going to be a price to pay in the medium term and the longer and the somewhat long run for all the excess of the recent Bush years, and indeed the excess of the last 25 years. Will China, et cetera, start losing confidence in the dollar? I think China made what I thought was a major symbolic statement before the G20 meeting, when it said we want to look for another reserve currency. That is bad news for America in the short run, although it's not going to happen in the short run. But it's probably good news in the long run, because what happened in the U.S. is, because we are a reserve currency, we could run these huge trade deficits. We could borrow like crazy. And we did allow and the dollar did go high. When you run a trade deficit, you put all those dollars into the hands of foreign manufacturers and so forth, who give them to their government. And the government usually sells them, except in the case of America, because the American dollar is so strong, they put it back, is the only reserve currency around, they put it back into this country and drive the dollar up. Well, what happens? It drives our manufacturing down. It keeps our wages low. So we pay, and it enables us to borrow. And what happens is people borrow at low interest rates because they're not making satisfactory wages. That's my central view of it, my one major takeaway from this conversation, I would say. And we've got to start changing that. So even if the dollar no longer is the reserve currency in the world, I think in the long run, the U.S. will benefit. The world will be more balanced. In the short run, it's hard to get our head around what the short-term consequences of that could be. But the China wish won't happen in the short run unless there's a dollar crisis or some kind of sharp drop in the dollar. And we should probably talk about that on another phone call.
Jeff, what would be the other reserve currency?
Well, you'd have to, you know, the China, we do have SDRs, Remember back Bretton Woods in 1944, John Maynard Keynes did not want the dollar to be the major currency. The U.S. did, because you gain some advantages in the short run from that. He wanted there to be a package of currencies that the major countries contributed to. That's what could replace the dollar then, and that's what China is talking about, is a composite of currencies of the major nations that are not, that and the value of which is not dependent on any one nation. And I think that might make sense, but it clearly requires extraordinary international cooperation. And it remains to be seen whether that's practical. That SDR would not replace our U.S. dollar, like the euro replaced the French franc. It would just be for trading and international capital flow purposes.
Well, look, this is certainly one of the biggest unfolding stories of our lifetime. In the pages of the magazine and on this call, Jeff, you've added immeasurably to our ongoing education on these questions, and I hope you'll continue to participate with us in this process. After examining a little bit about the global economy and a little more about the domestic economy, I wanted to turn the conversation for a few minutes over to another president in our midst, and that's President Theresa Stack, who runs the Nation Company and who has a micro economy to deal with of her own that is no less challenging, and had some interesting news about the state of the nation. I'd like to introduce Theresa Stack.
Thanks, Ham, and thanks everybody for joining us on the call today. I want to start out with the good news, because there is some good news here. The nation is currently reaching its largest audience ever, and if you combine our print readership, the web, radio and TV appearances, books, events, all of those combined, and we are reaching almost 2 million people every month with Nation Stories. And that's really remarkable. To give you some perspective, when I started here in 1993, about 85,000 people were seeing Nation content every month, and now we're talking about millions of people. And despite industry trends, our print circulation has held up pretty well over the past few years. We're down only a little bit from a time point in 2005, and we currently have 180,000 print subscribers, and that's actually double what it was when George Bush was first elected. The website has grown also dramatically, up 36% in unique monthly visitors in 2008. And a lot of the websites that cover politics and news saw increases in 2008, but their increases overall for the all news sites was more in the 25% range. So 36% increase in Nation website users is another sign that we're doing things right on that end. Associates donations were strong in 2008, and so far they're holding steady for 2009. And print advertising, we actually managed to grow that in 2008, and this is at a time when the entire print ad industry seems to be imploding. So that's another promising sign. 2009 ad sales are down, but they're still better than budget, and they're still better than what the rest of the industry is seeing. So those are some good points, some strong points. So I want to talk a little bit about the bad news or the challenges that we have going forward. Most of you should have received the 2008 end-of-year financials that we sent out earlier in the month. And after several years of breaking even or even making a little money, we did run a deficit in 2008 of $540,000. Of that, about $300,000 was cash losses if you subtract out non-cash items like depreciation and amortization. The deficit is unfortunately largely due to the $500,000 postal increase that we were hit with in 2007 and that we continue to work to reverse. We also had additional postal hikes of 5% and another 4% in 2008-2009. And we've seen dramatic increases in paper costs, up almost 30%, and health insurance costs, which I'm sure you are all aware of, is a big problem. In 2009, we expect things to be more difficult, and we're anticipating a larger loss of about $790,000. All of our budgets are anticipating that the recession is going to affect advertising sales, donations, and subscriptions. But we do budget conservatively, and I'm very hopeful that we're going to beat this number. We're going to do better. The first quarter results so far, we are better than budget. Our direct mail that we used to solicit new subscribers we mailed in February actually did very well, just as well as it did last February. So remember, that was just at the height of the primary season. So that's a strong sign. So how are we going to prepare for the future? This is definitely a serious economic challenges that we face. So we also need to take advantage of this unique moment in history. We want to be a part of the conversation about progressive solutions in this country, and now it's clearly not the time for the nation to be retreating as a business. We need to work harder to get our voice amplified even more. So we continue to try to control expenses. So we run a very tight ship as it is, but we're always looking at new ways to save money in ways that would work alongside our values. And a good example of that is last year we were actually able to find a recycled paper stock to print the magazine on that was cheaper than our old non-recycled stock. So that was sort of a win-win situation. We're working very hard to turn TheNation.com into a self-sustaining business. This past year, we hired a new web salesperson. We retrained the entire ad sales staff. We have a new web producer and assistant editor. And we recently engaged a very dynamic consultant for our website. She worked on the launch of the New York Times, more recently worked with Yahoo and the launch of the Daily Beast. She's incredibly disciplined and energetic, and she's already helped us with our strategy going forward on the web. So we're excited about that. We're also investing in a new content management system, and that will make us much more nimble on the website, being able to take advantage more quickly of new technologies. We've expanded our advertising opportunities on TheNation.com, and we've also developed, thanks to Peggy Randall here, a remarkably successful online fundraising program that's bringing in now hundreds of thousands of dollars that weren't there previously. We've been investing in multimedia content, the New Nation videos podcast, very popular slideshow. And, of course, I think we're all concerned with we want to get the nation in front of a younger audience. And to that end, we are reimagining, re-energizing our Student Nation web pages. We have a very popular annual student writing contest. We have three student journalism conferences each year. So we're very focused on how we can introduce the nation to young people and turn them into lifelong readers and supporters, hopefully. So I would say that overall, even though it's a very challenging time, we're cautiously optimistic. Thankfully, our business model is more diverse than many other magazines and newspapers that you're probably reading about. This should protect us somewhat from the ravages of the recession. And what makes us really unique, what sets us apart from other magazines and newspapers right now, are people like you on this call. It's the 30,000-plus Nation associates who donate money to this organization to support this kind of content. And they donate quite a bit above and beyond the cost of their subscription. And, of course, our circle of 100 members who are also on the call, and their annual investment is essential to our past and our future success. And that's something that other magazines really don't have. They don't have that passion, that dedicated support that we do, and we thank you for that, and you're helping us get through this and emerge even stronger. So we're happy to take any questions that you have about the financials that you were provided with. Or
just a reminder, if you have a question for Teresa about finances and the state of the nation, just press the star key on your phone.
Teresa, I'd like to ask, just as an opening question, you referenced in your remarks the bombardment of articles that we're all reading about the decline of newspapers and the shifts that are taking place more rapidly than we anticipated in the way in which people are consuming information. What's your sense of the position of the nation in relation to future print and the conversion of print operations to the digital platforms?
That's the most important question there is out there right now, and it's something we're all struggling with. But I think that we are in a position of strength when it comes to that. The print subscribers still pay the vast majority of the cost of producing this content. That being said, as we move on to the website, there are advertisers more willing to support political content on the web than they were in print, for instance. And again, we have this donor section, this donor group, who other magazines cannot depend on. And they're really trying to make a switch from advertising-supported print to an electronic media where the advertising dollars are just not really what they are. So I think we're always looking at the technology. We are ready to adapt as needed, I think we'll be ready. And the great thing is that the internet has absolutely exponentially increased our audience, and that can be nothing but good.
Do we have any questions from any of the callers for Teresa and the arrangements with the magazine?
Is that an old question?
All right.
Teresa, I think you answered all the questions. Let me close if I could. I wanted to just say that the nation does have this extraordinary creative model, unique, and that there are two people on this call, Victor Nevesky and Ham Fish, who are central to devising that model, which has given us the resilience and strength to keep not only the nation, but as I said earlier, its many moving parts, including this internet, which has extended our reach in extraordinary ways. And it's that model that gives us the resilience and strength at a time when newspapers around this country are being shuttered or gutted and other models aren't working that well. You are key to that, the people who've been on the call today. Thank you. And it's been a pleasure hearing from you. I want to thank Jeff, if he's still on the call, for his...
Well, thank you. Let me thank you all and all the callers as well.
I was taking many notes as you spoke, so I hope some of those on this call were as well. And I want to thank the Circle members, because you, Circle of 100 partnership members, you play a vital role in keeping the nation strong and engaged, not only to lay out positive visions of a future we all want to live in, but engaged in the battles Jeff mentioned. So if you're interested in talking about your Circle of 100 membership, or if you'd like to receive more information about joining the Circle, please email us at rsvp@thenation.com. That's rsvp@thenation.com, or call Peggy Randall at 212-209-5400. Onwards. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.